We've got to go to swearing in.
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here today. We have a number of bills that are set for public hearing and possible work session. I think at this point, as far as I know, we're going to just run through the agenda as it is printed, unless there's some unknown reasons that we need to move stuff around. So we'll start with SJR 4, open up a public hearing. Laura?
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. So, Senate Joint Resolution 4 comes to us at the request of Secretary of State Kate Brown. There is no revenue impact. We do have a fiscal statement issued. So just to give you a little bit of it, at this time, the fiscal impact to the Secretary of State's office is indeterminate because the cost of producing and distributing the voter's pamphlet is determined by the total number of initiatives and legislative referrals on the ballot, and by the number of arguments submitted in support or opposition of those ballot measures. And this information will not be known until after the election filing deadlines. So we don't have any amendments before us. So to tell you a little bit about the background, there is no mandatory retirement age for judges at the federal level, of course. At the state level, currently 32 states plus the District of Columbia have mandatory retirement age for judges. The Oregon Constitution contains a mandatory requirement that a judge of any court retire at the end of the calendar year in which the judge reaches the age of 75. Mandatory retirement has been the topic of several initiatives as well as court challenges throughout the nation, and we've had really mixed results on that front. Oregon's mandatory retirement age was most recently challenged in a 2014 case, which we will hear about during testimony. Senate Joint Resolution 4 repeals the mandatory retirement age and instead states that the Legislative Assembly or the people may not fix an age for mandatory retirement of judges of any court. If passed, Senate Joint Resolution 4 will be submitted to the people for their approval or rejection at the next general election held throughout the state.
All right. Well, thank you. We have five individuals who have signed up on the registry. It looks like everyone is going to be in the proponent side, except for Justice Brewer, who has left it conveniently blank. So I'm not sure who should we be leading off with. Is there anyone that we
have? One more, Jane Landis.
Okay. So we. Why don't we do this? I'm going to start with the three from Columbia County. The first person who signed in, I cannot read your name, but I got Angie, Agnes Marie Petersall, I guess, and Al Peterson. And then whoever signed in the very beginning, it's
Don Calvert.
Okay, Don. Why don't you all three come on up? All three of you come up at the same time. Don't be bashful. We got three chairs here. This is the way I work for efficiency. I get three up here. We'll run through everyone, and then we'll ask questions.
Gosh, I should do that at the Planning Commission.
There we go.
So are we supposed to state our name?
You sit down.
No, you get to sit down.
Name and address for the record.
What I do need you to do is at least state your name for the record. You do not have to give us your address unless you just want us to know where to send cards to, but that is not necessary. And we do not swear witnesses in, at least we haven't done one yet.
Not yet.
We may have a chance. So whoever would like to go first?
Calvert, go ahead.
I'll go ahead first. I don't want to thank you for having us.
All righty.
I don't want to insult your intelligence by reading my testimony because I sent it by email, and I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read it yet.
Yeah. Let's do it this way. First, I need you to put your name on the record as who you are, and then why don't you just tell us.
My name is Don Calver.
And then why don't you just summarize.
Senior judge, State of Oregon.
Okay.
Been a member of the Oregon State Bar for 55 years. Circuit judge, senior judge for 46-plus years, resident of Columbia County.
And, Your Honor, what I would suggest, instead of you reading your testimony, why don't you just tell us, summarize what you want us to hear. We have it as part of the OLIS system, and all the members will be reviewing that if they haven't already.
Yeah. Basically, mine is short and sweet. As you'll find when you read my testimony, I would tell you that changing the law to allow judges to serve past the age of 75 will have such insignificant impact upon the courts of the state of Oregon that it's really a no-brainer. There are very few judges that desire to work past the age of 75. And I think you can find that from the state court administrator's office. I know of three in Multnomah County, very fine judges that wish to serve past the age of 75 and were upset that they had to retire. One was Dick Burke, one was Mercedes Diaz, and I got to recall who the other one was, Tony Cachado. They all reached the age of 75, were very active mentally, and wanted to continue to work. I don't know of any elected, yourselves included, personnel in the state of Oregon, officers, who are limited by age from serving in your capacity, except judges. And the majority of the states favor no limitation. There are those that do. You can find arguments on either side. And as I tell people, you can justify anything if you want. You can find facts and figures to do so. But very few people want to work past. I retired at age 63 with 26 plus years as a circuit and resident judge. I retired 19 years ago. So I had no desire to work till I was past 75. But I just think that so few people, so few judges, but there are some who have the experience, the knowledge, the desire, and why limit those people that can be of assistance to those in the judicial arena and to the citizens of the state of Oregon? I'll answer any questions that you have, but I submit my email testimony to you.
All right, thank you very much. So what we'll do is we'll take everyone on the panel and get your testimony, and then we'll open it up for any questions for all three of you. So who'd like to go next? Okay.
I have a hard time sitting when I'm addressing people such as you, because I was raised in St. Helens in a parochial school, and you stood up when you addressed anyone of importance. So this is hard for me to sit down.
Well, I appreciate
name
that.
My name is Agnes Marie Peterson, and I was born and raised in Columbia County, and I would disagree with what Judge Kelber said about himself. He's still working to this day. He isn't formally a judge of the state of Oregon. However, he has been doing mediation and arbitration and other things. He also acts as a very active participant in helping his family. So what he said about himself not doing anything for the past 19 years is inaccurate. About myself, I would like to compliment the state of Oregon on having a Secretary of State like Kate Brown. First of all, she kept me off of the ballot because she believed that I ran for circuit judge in Columbia County. And I did so. I went down and I saw Kelber, and I says, I think I'm going to file for judge. And he says, there's a constitutional provision that says you can't. And I read it, and it didn't seem to apply to me because I wasn't a sitting judge, I wasn't a he, and I was, according to the Secretary of State, past 75, so it didn't apply to me at all. So I filed, and Kate Brown's office declared that I was not okay to run for circuit judge. I was disqualified because I was over 75. I've never admitted that that charge was true, and I don't intend to admit it today, and I will never admit it.
And we won't put you under oath to ask that question.
And I'm not going to answer it, I'm not going to answer it in any event. I think that this has a double discrimination factor. I think it discriminates against the elderly, and I think it discriminates against women. It really discriminates against women, and in my material, the very first comment was, here's one for you, Merce. I knew Mercedes Diaz from the time I started practicing law. Calber reminds me that the three of us took the bar examination together. So we would have been lawyers for 55 years together. I've been practicing law full-time in Columbia County since I was 24 years of age. Don't do the math, but I'm now 55 years later still practicing law in the same place. And I...
Full-time.
Yeah, I'm full-time. And my husband said about 6 months ago to me, oh, Agnes, we're so lucky. And I said, we are? Why, John? He says, well, we never work for anyone else, so we don't have to retire. Isn't that a marvelous way to approach the last years of your life? You don't have to do anything. What I'm asking you on behalf of the judges of the state of Oregon, to be the first state who had the courage to repeal a stupid law or change it so that people are treated equally, that all the members of this government are treated equally. They can work as long as they want to. They don't have to. If they don't want to, they can retire, or they don't have to retire. I hope that you approve a Senate Joint Resolution 4 and present it to the voters, because I think we're in a time when the future governor of this state should not have her hands tied as to whom she can appoint if she chooses to. And I really ask for your approval of this provision. Thank you very much for having us here.
All right, thank you. And Al?
My name's Al Peterson. I'm related to this woman down at the other end of the bench. I'm also an architect. And most laws in the state are construed to cover health, safety, and welfare. This particular provision does neither of those. Airplane pilots are required to stop flying airplanes commercially at a certain age because their reaction times go down and they're physically determined, arbitrarily or not, to not qualify because of the health and the safety and the welfare of the people who they are transporting. I think it would be difficult to construe that a judge is somehow protecting the health, safety, and welfare of someone by sitting in a desk and writing an opinion. So I think that this provision does not actually cover what most laws are meant to cover, which is the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of the state. So this law is completely outside of any meaning of what most people consider what laws are for. I, as an architect, am bound by certain provisions which have to do with health, safety, and welfare. But again, as an architect, I don't have to retire at a given age because what I do doesn't directly affect the health, safety, and welfare on an immediate plane. If I draw something and I and my engineers get together and do some calculations that are wrong, clearly I may be at fault. But usually in that case, there's a lot of checks and balances along the way, and those things are tend to be checked. But I don't have a direct there's no direct relationship to what I do and the direct health, safety, and welfare of someone. And certainly what judges do does not, and therefore from a legal basis, in my opinion, not being a lawyer, in my opinion, it has no basis and no meaning, so it should be eliminated.
Thank you. Let me ask if there's any questions. All right, I don't see any, but what I do want to do is just put on the record, because there's a couple of statements about us passing laws. As everyone probably knows, this isn't the Constitution. What we will be able to do if we move forward is present the question to the voters. Real quickly, I'd like to see it, the amended Section 1A of Article 7, which is what this would be addressing. It was, in fact, a question that went to the voters under SJR 3 in 1959 that was approved by the voters in 1960. I don't know if Laura has already looked at any of the history on that, but we might just get that up before we actually take a vote on this. But I think it's important that everyone understands that we, the legislature, cannot change this. All we can do is present the question to the voters, just like it was in 1959 or 1960 when they approved it, and then they will make that decision. But thank you very much for your comments and your testimony, and we'll see if we can't take care of that double discrimination. All right, so I have three other individuals that are scheduled here, and that's Dave Brewer, Rachel Altman, and Jane Landis. Why don't you three please come forward? And Dave, did you need Josh with you, or are you going solo? Okay. And while those three are coming up, I'm just going to ask, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on SJR 4 today? All right, I'm going to let the three of you choose who gets to go first.
Okay. Honorable Committee, I'm Jane Landis. I live at 745 East Clay in Monmouth, Oregon. Frankly, I'm quite insulted by the discrimination in any form, and in this case, it's age discrimination. May 2nd, I will be 95 years old. I've been an Oregonian in 90 plus years. My service to this great state was an elementary teacher in Dallas, Oregon. I retired at 62, but at the request of the several principals and teachers, I continue to regularly substitute teach until the age of 79. And at that time, it was evident that I needed to stay home with my husband, who was ill. I continue to live independently in my home. I do my own gardening and travel extensively and provide services for the community and my church. Since 1976, I have maintained financial records and completed banking for my church. Additionally, I am fully responsible for Rookery All Grange and Monmouth Independence Cleaners financial reports. The latter organization requires accounting to the state as nonprofit, which is done faithfully and accurately. Federal and state laws and regulations offer multiple means to screen for incompetence and fraud. To determine an arbitrary age for release of service is a terrible social injustice. I stand before you today as an educator, appealing your common desire to do what is right. Eliminate age-based mandatory retirement. Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Rochelle Altman, and I serve as Legislative Director to the Secretary of State. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of SJR 4. I won't repeat what Ms. Hansel provided regarding the background of the legislation, but do want to add a few things. Article 7, Section 1 of the Constitution currently requires a judge to retire at the end of the calendar year in which they achieve the age of 75 without any exception. The mandatory requirement is based solely on age without regard to whether the judge maintains the physical and mental capacity to fulfill judicial duties. I want to also add that this constitutional provision has been interpreted to make ineligible those who are over the age of 75 but interested in serving as judges. That is correct. Finally, ORS 1.310 already provides that a judge's inability to perform judicial duties may already form the basis for involuntary retirement. And that statutory provision lays out a detailed process under which a judge can be compelled to retire based on inability to perform judicial duties. Lastly, this statutory provision will remain consistent with the Constitution if SJR 4 does become the law of the land. Oregon has repeatedly seen judges forced to retire at the age of 75 and has also seen some attorneys barred from serving on the bench, even when their mental abilities would have allowed them to offer valuable judicial services to our communities. To name just a few, such individuals have included former Judge Mercedes Diaz, Senior Judge Ronald Tom, and Agnes Marie Peterson, whom we heard testify just a few minutes earlier. Secretary Brown and many members of the legal community believe that constitutional and statutory mandates for the age-based retirement of judges are discriminatory and unfair anachronisms. I want to also note that the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, has no age-based mandatory requirement, and in fact, 4 of the 9 sitting judges are currently over the age of 75 years old. For these reasons, Secretary Brown supports SJR 4, which would repeal the Constitution's age-based retirement requirement and prohibit the legislature and the people from forcing judges to retire solely based on their age. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify in support of SJR 4, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you.
Chair Przonski and members of the committee, my name is Dave Brewer with the Oregon Supreme Court, and I do apologize for not completely filling in the form, Chair Przonski, but that was only out of an abundance of caution because OJD has not taken a formal position on this resolution. I'm here because I personally support it. And I also want to say that I have no intention of sitting until I reach age 75, so I doubt very much that this would ever affect me. But I do think, as you've heard from others, that this is the current limitation is an arbitrary limitation. It really smacks of age-based discrimination. There are people, and you've seen several of them here today, who would be wonderful judges past the age of 75. As you heard Judge Kalber indicate, this is not a huge impact issue in terms of raw numbers. Most judges retire before they reach age 75, and they do so willingly because they know it's time for any number of reasons for them to do that. In fact, I don't think we've ever had a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals, my former court, who served past the age of 69. I mean, it is demanding work. It's hard work. Which isn't to say, though, that there aren't a lot of folks who reach the age of 75 who couldn't do the work very, very well. There are. We don't expect this to affect a lot of people, but at least from a standpoint of fairness, it sort of sticks out like a sore thumb. We've taken a look elsewhere in the Constitution, the statutes and rules of the state, and I'm hard-pressed to find any other example of an arbitrary age-based retirement age like this one. And I'm sure that the reasons for it deep in the annals of history are out there somewhere for folks to find if they want to. But if you want to look at a balanced system, a system that's fair, that treats qualified seniors the same as it does everyone else, then this seems like an arbitrary limit to me personally, speaking for myself. You also heard at least one of the other speakers mention the fact that regardless of age, we do have an interbranch commission, the Judicial Fitness and Disability Commission in this state, that looks at issues of fitness in office. And it isn't just an age-related issue, but there are certainly ways to deal with any situation where somebody isn't qualified to serve. The only other thing, Chair Przonski and members of the committee, that I'd add at this point is that particularly on the civil law practice side, there are a lot of folks who give to the public and to the bar with many years of service in the practice of law. And some of those folks aren't ready for any number of reasons to come to the bench until they reach an older age, sometimes in their 60s. And if we arbitrarily cap their service, I think there's also a real risk of losing a rich level and depth of experience and wisdom for the people of the state. And so I think it's an arbitrary cap. Someone else, not me, could stand up here and make arguments about why we could keep it. I won't do that. I don't think it's appropriate. And I think we're also depriving not just folks who could give good service of the opportunity to do it, but also the people of the state of a significant reservoir of wisdom and experience. So I'm here personally to testify in favor of the resolution, and we stand ready to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz.
Just a comment, and I support this as well. I think there are other ways that fitness can be determined, which are more appropriate than just based on an arbitrary age. But my one comment, Justice Brewer, is you're a long way from 75, but my hope is that you continue to serve on the bench for a long time.
All right. So I do have a question, and Mrs. Landis, it's really for you, and I don't want to put you on the spot as it comes to recall, but you said you taught in the Dallas School District for a number of years.
Yes.
Do you remember a student by the name of Lane Shutterly?
Do you remember a student by the name of Lane Shutterly?
Oh, yes.
I was afraid you might. So I think afterwards we'll have to talk, just because I assume you can tell us a few stories that we probably want to share with Lane at another time.
Good point.
So thank you all very much for coming forward. Really appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on SJR 4? Not seeing, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And the chair has been convinced that maybe I can get the history done and we can talk about it on the floor if we want to work the bill today.
Yes.
So I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on SJR 4. Senator Cruz.
Chair, I move SJR 4 to the Senate floor with a due pass motion.
All right. Senator Cruz moves SJR 4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes.
Is there any questions, any discussion, any objections?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I just want to note that this has a subsequent referral to rules. So.
What?
Oh, it does.
Okay. It does.
Ms. Chair, could I modify my motion?
Sure, please do.
I'm going
to
do
Would you like me to make the motion?
No, Ms. Chair, I revised my motion to say that we move the bill to the President's desk with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Rules.
With a due pass?
With a due pass.
So Senator Cruz modifies his motion to move that we submit the bill with a due pass recommendation to the President for consideration of the subsequent referral that has been placed on it to Rules, but again with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah.
Any discussion on that motion, amended motion? Any objections to that motion?
Nice catch, Senator Burdick. Thank you.
Yeah, we were just trying to move this really quick.
I don't blame you.
All right. So we'll go ahead and approve the motion. So it was on its way to the President's desk, which is a formality, and then we'll go on to the Rules Committee. And I'll tell you the reason why it has to go to the Rules Committee is because if it goes to the ballot, the Rules Committee is the one that actually puts together the ballot provisions that are necessary to put it onto the next general election, which would be 2016. And they normally do this with any other legislation that's being proposed to go to the voters. And so they'll do that as a combination of what other bills they may have. So this is a standard operating procedure that we use to move a bill that it needs to be referred to the voters to send it to the committee that actually presents the bill to the legislature for consideration on the floor. So with that, we'll close that SJR 4. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 367. And Laura?
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 367 is actually my bill today. This comes to you from the State Bar Consumer Law Section. This bill is not ready to move today. We have a Dash 1 amendment, and we do not have the fiscal statement back on the Dash 1 amendment. This bill deals with property in a foreclosure sale. There's a redemption period of 180 days after the foreclosure sale in which the judgment debtor or the mortgage holder can redeem the property. In that meantime, the purchaser of the property has a certificate of sale at the start of the redemption period and has immediate right to use the property and often lives at the property or enjoys it in some manner. When it comes to a homeowners association or a condo, there might be fees involved, and it's unclear in statute who is responsible for those fees during the redemption period. So Senate Bill 367 clarifies that certificate holder is jointly and severably liable with the property owner for all of the fees. However, the Dash 1 amendments remove the joint and several liability and make it solely the certificate holder who is liable for all assessments on homeowner and condo fees during the redemption period.
All right, thank you. I have Kelly Harpster. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Harpster. I'm an attorney from Lake Oswego, and I'm here today as a member of the Consumer Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. The Consumer Law Section is made up of over 200 attorneys from all across the state who work on consumer issues, ranging from foreclosures to debt collection practices to disputes over consumer goods and services. And I'm here to express the section's support of Senate Bill 367, and specifically as amended with the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments are necessary because there was some miscommunication or confusion communicating between the section and legislative council about the intent of the bill. And as I describe the problem a little bit, I think that'll become obvious. So. The ordinary cases under current law for homeowners association and condominium association dues, as you would expect, it's the owner of the property that is personally liable for all of the assessments. And the problem is during the six-month redemption period after a judicial foreclosure sale, equitable ownership gets split from bare legal title. So when a foreclosure sale occurs, a judicial foreclosure sale, the purchaser at sale immediately gets a right of possession, the right to use the property, the right to collect the rents, all of the normal property rights incident to ownership. But bare legal title isn't transferred till the end of the redemption period. So that's where the confusion results. Now, there's actually a common practice and a common understanding between the folks that deal with this every day, which are the lenders and the homeowners associations, about who's supposed to pay. So as you know, most judicial foreclosures, the property goes back to the bank. That's the reality. And so the common practice and the common understanding of how this is supposed to work is that the bank pays, or that the purchaser at sale pays those assessments during the redemption period. However, there's obviously a little bit of ambiguity in the statute about how that's supposed to work, who's the owner for the purposes, and that's created a bit of confusion. So we get consumers who tend to go to bankruptcy attorneys, general practitioners, and others who read the statute and aren't sure who the owner is under these two different interpretations. Is it the equitable owner, or is it the person with bare legal title? So they end up getting bad advice. They end up getting in disputes. We also have occasional investors that come along that are not the banks and not regularly engaged in this, and so they're not aware of what the common practice is. The common understanding of the common practice is not only consistent with the laws that we have, but it's consistent with case law out of other jurisdictions. We don't have cases addressing it here in the state. And it's also consistent with good policy, since it's the purchaser at sale who has the use of the property, is collecting rents of the property, and is enjoying the benefits of the association. And so what the bill does is clarify, with the Dash 1 amendments, clarifies that it is the certificate holder, the purchaser at sale, who has sole liability for those assessments during the redemption period. And then, of course, if the borrower decides to redeem the property, they have to reimburse any advances that were made to pay assessments as part of the redemption amount. So with that, unless there are questions, the Consumer Law Section does support and hopes you will pass the bill with the Dash 1 amendments.
All right, thank you. Questions? All right, so basically what the Dash 1 is going to do, it's going to make it very clear whoever is, you know, say, in the process of purchasing or has actually paid the purchase price during that six-month period, they're going to be on the hook for whatever cost it is to the assessments, with the understanding that if you had a bank involved and the property is going back to them, they're going to be clearly the individuals. But this kind of just clarifies who is responsible. And then at the point of, let's say, there is a redemption, everyone understands that whoever is redeeming the property is on the hook for any costs that have been put out by the, let's say, the new purchaser, the person that would at that point have equity title, or they have the bearer.
If the borrower, the debtor, who was foreclosed, if they decide during the redemption period to exercise the redemption right, one of the things they would have to pay back, just like you have to pay back all of your other expenses, you have to pay back any advances for the assessments made by the purchaser since you don't keep the property then. That ordinarily works.
I think it's a quick question. I'm just wondering if the potential purchaser is aware of what those potential charges might be
The homeowners association? Yeah, there's
all those potential charges.
So there are CC&Rs and other things that are recorded depending on whether it's a condominium or so there's a recorded document that tells you basically how that works. In practice, the homeowners associations or the condominium associations, their attorneys are fairly good about contacting them fairly quickly.
And I would say, wouldn't there be some type of, I'm going to call it disclosure, but some type of document that would be prepared before someone's actually going in as to knowing what its outstanding debts and cost are?
Yeah, and it's just during the redemption period, so you're liable from the sale on. So there's a certificate of sale issued by the sheriff at the end. There's no question about who the purchaser
is.
Senator
Thatcher's asking is when the person comes to that sale, there is some type of notice as to what is encumbering that property.
Oh, that's a different. So this is only during the redemption from the sale forward, but that doesn't make the purchaser liable for assessments prior to the date.
Right.
It doesn't alter existing law.
I understand
at all.
That, but I think what we're trying to figure out is when does someone have notice of to what they would be paying during
what the amount of the assessments are, the same way that any other owner gets notice of the assessments.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 367? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. I understand the bill's not ready. We are looking at the Dash 1s as the vehicle that would be moving forward at this point, but we'll be coming back to that at an appropriate time. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open up the next public hearing, which is for Senate Bill 371. And Laura, I think you're on this one.
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 371 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar's Workers' Compensation Section. We don't have the paperwork on this today, so it's not ready to move. We have no amendments before us today. Currently in Oregon, insurers and self-insured employers are not required to provide a deceased worker's estate or their beneficiaries copies of the notice of closure in workers' compensation cases. Such parties may not become aware of their right to appeal or may not become aware with sufficient time to actually act. And the current appeal time period is 60 days. Additionally, Oregon law requires the insurer or self-insured employer to pay certain costs for depositions arranged by the injured worker in reconsideration proceedings. The statute, however, is silent on the matter of interpreter services, and some insurers and self-insured employers have denied payment of interpreter fees. So Senate Bill 371 mandates that insurers and self-insured employers pay the costs for necessary interpreter services and requires insurers and self-insured employers to mail a copy of the notice of closure to the deceased worker's estate and allows them to mail copies to beneficiaries as well. Senate Bill 371 also allows beneficiaries not receiving a copy of the notice of closure 1 year from the date the notice was mailed to the deceased worker's estate to request consideration.
Okay. Just clarification, and maybe whoever's going to come up and speak will be able to help us. So that 1 year starts to run at the point of when the mailing occurs or when the person has knowledge that...
When the mailing occurs.
Okay. All right. I have three people that are signed up to give testimony today. I'd like for all three of you to please come forward. Michael Orlando, Tim, is it Cohen or Cowan? And then Keith Simple. Well, gentlemen, whoever would like to start off, if you could give us your name first, that'd be wonderful.
I can go first. My name is Michael Orlando. I'm an attorney in Lake Oswego, and I practice in the workers' compensation field. I'm currently a part of a subcommittee of the workers' compensation section called the Access to Justice Committee, and it is a committee made up of equal members of attorneys who represent workers, employers, and administrative law judges. This proposal came out, at least the part of the reconsideration process of the mailing of the notice of closures, came about as a result of a 2010 Court of Appeals case called Safe v. Wild. In that case, there was a minor beneficiary living in another state who never became aware of her father's claim, who passed away, and thereby the notice of closure became final after 60 days. What we're proposing in those cases where the beneficiary was not mailed a copy of the notice of closure, that they would have up to 1 year to appeal that. And it is from the date of the notice of closure, not from their date of knowledge of it. You know, this circumstance, this doesn't come around too often, but when it does, it can be quite impactful. And so we're just proposing kind of a change to that. To that current format. As far as the interpreter services, same thing. There just came some disputes where, you know, we'd have the deposition for the notice of closure, and the insurer is is required to pay for the transcription and the court reporter costs, but not the interpreter services. So some disputes arose as a result of that, and we're just trying to put a stop to that as well. So.
Okay, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I'll go ahead and go next. I'm Keith Semple. I'm an attorney in Eugene. I am the 2015 chair of the workers' compensation section, which is proposing this legislation. And I'm also speaking here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to support, express support for this bill. I want to make it clear that this is not a trial lawyer's bill. We haven't had any, I haven't personally had any involvement in drafting the legislation, and the trial lawyers haven't had any input on the legislation, the language either. But we are strongly in support of this. As Mr. Orlando just testified, these situations don't come up all that often, but when they do, they're devastating to the people involved. And they are. This is important legislation, and we would urge you to move it along accordingly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Sir, excuse me. My name is Tim Cowan, and I have the trademark as a citizens lobbyist. And what I would like to do is just ask you to consider defining workers' comp in this case or any other one. And let me tell you why. In 2005, I slipped and fell in a hotel lobby bathroom. I suffered a traumatic brain injury. I was in a coma for a month and a half. Intensive care for 9. Then when I came home, I found out that when you're promoted in a company to management, you're not covered by the company insurance, because there's a distinction between being an employee and being a manager. Then, since I had workers' comp taken out of my check for probably, what, maybe 45 years, found out that that didn't cover workers' comp. I was not covered either by the company or by the state, but I had something taken out of my check for 45 years. So, what I would tell you is I doubt that citizens of Oregon know whether they're covered by workers' comp or not. They have no idea at all. And when you get promoted, I have never had anyone tell me, hey, we have a promotion for you. It's really going to be great. And the best part of it is you're not covered by workers' comp. So you have posters, I think, in areas where employees go, like lunchrooms, and you think you're covered by workers' comp. And because it's taken out of your paycheck, you think you're paying for it. So imagine what happens when you find out you're not. So the only thing I ask you is define workers' comp and make sure that people understand what is workers' comp. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me ask if there's any questions. Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. And I know the bill's not ready to be moved today. We'll look at the issue that you've mentioned. And let me see if there's anyone else who's in the room today who wanted to give testimony on 371. Not seeing anyone. Yes, sir.
I did have a fourth grade teacher named Cheryl in Wilhelmina, and I always disagreed with her grade. So I just thought I'd let you know that.
All righty. Thank you very much. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 371. And we'll open up our last public hearing for the day, which is Senate Bill 381.
Chana? Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 381 comes to you from the State Bar and deals with the Oregon State Bar and its Board of Governors. So it increases the membership of the board to 19 members and includes a new member who must be an Oregon licensed attorney who maintains a practice outside of the state. It also gives the board clear authority to establish dates on which professional liability fund contributions must be made, and it removes the fixed timelines for correction of delinquency of payments. It also deals with the structure of the Board of Bar Examiners. However, the proposed -1 amendments remove the provisions modifying the Board of Bar Examiners. It is not ready to move today because we are still waiting on the fiscal for the -1 amendments.
All right, thank you. So I have Helen, is it Hirschfeld?
Hirschfeld.
Why don't you please come forward? Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 381? When you're ready.
Good morning, Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee. I was instructed to try not to infect the microphone with my cold germs today. Apologize for that. My name is Helen Hirschfeld, and I'm general counsel for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 381 on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. The Senate Bill 381 addresses two distinct but important issues with respect to governance at the Oregon State Bar. First, the bill creates a new position on the Board of Governors to represent out-of-state members. The bar is currently governed by an 18-member Board of Governors, 14 of whom are lawyers who are elected from throughout the state of Oregon, and 4 members of whom who are members of the public who are not lawyers who are appointed based on their areas of interest and expertise. In order to serve on the board as a lawyer member, your principal place of business must be in the state of Oregon. The Oregon State Bar currently has over 2,500 active members, active lawyer members, whose principal offices are outside of the state of Oregon, and those members are currently not represented on the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. So this bill would remedy that problem. The second issue is that the bill makes changes to the timeline for curing non-payment of the professional liability fund assessment. Oregon is unique in that it requires lawyers who have their principal office for the private practice of law here in Oregon to maintain professional liability coverage. The Professional Liability Fund is the organization that provides that coverage, and if a lawyer fails to pay the assessment to the Professional Liability Fund for the coverage, the lawyer can be and is administratively suspended from the practice of law. Currently, the Oregon State Bar is required to give notice of delinquency for non-payment of the assessment at 30 days and 60 days after the due date for the assessment. Senate Bill 381 would remove those fixed dates, but still require that the Oregon State Bar give notice of delinquency and an opportunity to cure the default. It removes the specific timelines. Primarily, the reason for this is because the Oregon State Bar is in the process of purchasing and will be implementing soon new association management software, and this allows the bar flexibility both in terms of aligning all of the due dates and in terms of putting into place new software. So that's the purpose for those amendments. The third section of Senate Bill 381, as mentioned, we're asking to be eliminated after discussions with the Chief Justice and others. We realize that this particular provision needs further work, so that's the reason for that amendment. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
All right, questions. First, Senator Thatcher, then Senator Cruz.
So it would create a position for out-of-state attorneys based elsewhere to be a member of the board. What do other states do?
Other states that Chair Brzozinski and Senator Thatcher, other states I know that other states do have a position for out-of-state members. I couldn't give you the exact figures right now, but I'm happy to bring that back to the committee's attention if you'd like. But I know that some other states do the same thing.
Similar question. I'm just trying to figure out how would this advantage the board to have an out-of-state member on it? I'm just wondering why we're going down this road at this point in time.
Chair Przanski and Senator Cruz, there are two advantages. One is giving people representation who don't currently have it on the board, and it's a relatively significant number of members. We have approximately 15,000 active members, so 2,500 of whom have their principal place of business outside the state of Oregon, so that's one representation. Secondly, with the borders for the practice of law are starting to disappear, and so it's very important for the Board of Governors to hear perspectives from lawyers who are practicing in other states but who still do have an interest in the Oregon State Bar. What's going on in those other states? How can Oregon be more responsive to multi-jurisdictional practice? Those kinds of issues. And so it's the board is very interested in hearing that out-of-state practice perspective as well.
Okay. Just a follow-up, I guess, on this understanding we're in this new technical era. I'm assuming that if a person was elected into this new position and they're out of state, except for someone that might be just across the border, like in Vancouver, that they are, is the Board of Governors going to be requiring their presence to be personal presence, or will they be doing GoToMeeting or something type of software to participate?
Chair Przanski, the anticipation is that they will be encouraged to participate in the same way that other bar members participate. I'll tell you that of the 2,500 members who have their offices outside of Oregon, the vast majority of those are either in Washington or California, and so we don't expect there to be huge barriers to their participation on the board. And we have asked out-of-state members whether they are interested in this position, and they have expressed an interest. In fact, the House of Delegates, we have a representative from out-of-state on the House of Delegates, and the House of Delegates were going to propose that the board do this. And so there is great interest in it, and I anticipate that there would be participation, if that's the concern.
Senator Burdick.
The bill says their principal office, but I imagine there are lawyers whose principal office is out of state, but they live in Oregon. Is that, would people who actually have their residence in Oregon be eligible, or did you anticipate requiring them to actually live out of state?
Senator, Chair Przanski and Senator Burdick, the qualification is where your principal office is. So if a lawyer was residing in Oregon, that would not be relevant to whether they would be eligible to serve on the Board of Governors. The key issue would be where their principal office for the practice of law would be. So if their principal office is in Vancouver, Washington, but they're residing in Oregon, they would be eligible to run for that out-of-state position.
Chair, I just see a logistical problem here with, these lawyers are pretty busy, and somebody living in Southern California, how much they would actually be able to participate.
I'm assuming that the Board of Governors do have some type of bylaws or agreements that if a person misses X number of meetings and consecutive meetings, that they can, in fact, be removed. Just because they're not actively participating?
Chair Przanski, there's not a specific bylaw that I'm aware of that provides for removal, but I will say that board members who do not participate are approached and asked whether they are still interested in serving, and oftentimes they simply resign if they are unable to attend meetings. You know, we have had in the past members on the Board of Governors who come from Vail, Oregon, which in some ways is a lot more difficult to come to Tigard, Oregon from Vail, Oregon than it might be from Los Angeles, California, for example. And we've not had any trouble with those members participating. Our board members, when they make a decision to run and join the Board of Governors, we've found that they are very active participants, and we've not had a problem with members participating, regardless of where they come from.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. It's following up from some other question up here, but you mentioned that it gave the Board of Governors an opportunity to hear about multi-jurisdictional concerns for the practice of law. Would they not have that opportunity otherwise?
Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, there are other ways that they can hear those concerns, but not as directly. And not as easily. They would have to think about the issue to begin with and then invite someone from out of state to comment on particular issues, as opposed to having somebody who is present in the meeting at the time to raise it, something that they may not otherwise think of.
Okay, so I think this is all we have, but I do think there's, since we know we can't move the bill today because we don't have the fiscal and stuff like that, Senator Burdick brought up a question. I guess the question really is the bar fine with having just the principal office as the qualifier, or does the bar actually want to ensure that someone is, let's say, not living, such as in Portland, practicing in Vancouver? Because in a sense, I can understand the perspective, if you really want to get someone outside, I understand at the same time, if their principal office is in Washington, they're probably principally practicing Washington law. Mm-hmm. So that may not be an issue, but I would just say, if this is something that the bar wants us to clarify and ensure that you do have someone that actually not only practices from outside the state, but resides outside the state, we should know that before we move forward. We know we can't move forward today, so that's just out there. I don't think there'd be much heartburn either way. But this is something that's came up, so let's talk about it offline. And if that's something we want, let's do it now so we won't have to worry about coming back in 4 years from now and saying, you know, we really think maybe we need to put a qualifier on that. So with that, any other questions or comments? Not seeing any, we'll go ahead and close. Let me ask one more time. Is there anyone who still wants to testify on SB 381? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. I believe that concludes our work for today. And
your meeting tomorrow at 8:45 a.m.
8:45. That is when the big hand is on the nine.
That's with the full understanding that there is an event happening at 9:45 tomorrow.
Yeah.
That we're all going to go to.
We cannot change. We cannot move it up to 8:30. We're going to start, and we're going to just move as quickly as we can. And my goal is to have us out of here by the time we're supposed to start going down there, because I think the reality, I don't see how we're going to swear someone in prior to 10 a.m. It'll probably be 10:01 or thereabouts is what the governor-to-be would probably want. We'll just see whether or not we, the legislature, can get there in time to make that happen. With that, we're adjourned until 8:45 tomorrow. Thank you. We're adjourned until 8:45 tomorrow. Thank you.